What is up, good people of Crip Nation? Yeah, good to have you guys back. It's been a while. Finally back in the same room as Pizza Mind. He is no longer sick. He no longer has food poisoning. I am 100%, and we couldn't be more thrilled. Pete, how you feeling?
My brain is still full of melted cheese, and I'm just still recovering a little bit from the awful past couple weeks, but I'm super happy that we're back at full force, and we have Dave Hendricks, the founder and CEO of Vertalo, with us today. So Dave is the guy behind the sales guy, behind the devs, behind the curtains, behind the founders, behind the advisors of all these other things and all these little confusing layers. He's the guy that actually makes tokens come to life. So Dave, welcome to Crypto 101.
Wow. Thanks a lot, Pizza. Thanks, Bryce. Really great to be here. Excited to you guys today.
That was quite the introduction there, Pete. I like that. The man behind the curtain. It's almost like you're painting the picture of this cat as the Wizard of Oz or something. The Wizard of Oz is a security token.
Well, that's what it says his LinkedIn. He's the Wizard of Oz, right?
if there's a Wizard of Oz at Vertalo, it's probably my co-founder and CTO, Bagster. He not only is he a fantastic dancer, but he's got a PhD. He's got a PhD from Berkeley in math, specifically string theory. And so he's not a rocket scientist, but he is a not topologist. It's a very arcane background.
He's not a rocket scientist, just a string theory major.
Yeah. so he and I together spin the analog assets into digital gold. That's what we do.
I like that. And Dave, so tell us about your background. Catch us up. What were you doing before you were tokenizing assets at Vertalo?
So my career goes back pretty far, especially with regards to securitization. I started out my career at a little company, accounting firm called Arthur Andersen. I did that out of college, and I specialized in technology and databases. Arthur Andersen was an accounting firm, so I got involved in a lot of asset securitizations. And this is like back when all the toys were made out of wood in the 1990s. When I left Arthur Andersen, I went to work for a Goldman Sachs, J.E. Robert joint venture, and we helped dig the savings and loan crisis out of the ground and securitized all of these real estate assets. And I built databases to do that. I then ended up going to Oracle Corporation, as you know, a database company. And I ran the worldwide relationship between Oracle and Arthur Andersen. It was after that I met Bagster, my co-founder, and he and I were principals at what became the world's largest email marketing platform, something called CheetahMail. We learned there a lot about building massive scaling systems that could house the data of competitors on the same system, logically separated, providing basically big data and data delivery services to retailers and publishers who were getting into email. And we were really, really early in email, kind of like as early in as email as people who were in Bitcoin in 2011 or 12. And after that, I went on to co-found a company called Live Intent. That was in 2009. We invented programmatic advertising in email, meaning we place ads in emails that are rendered when you open the email. It was some stuff that happened in our Series D round of funding in 2015 that provided some of the inspiration for Vertalo. And William and our other co-founder, Gautam Gujral, who's a former SEC attorney and a securities lawyer, and I got together on a boat in 2016 in Berlin, and Vertalo was born.
Fascinating. I kind of picked up on a little something that you mentioned that we haven't really had discussed on the show. So the savings and loans crisis of the late 80s and 90s, can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that comes to bear, principally on why crypto exists. you know, one of the reasons. So talk about that experience and what, you know, for those of us that haven't heard of the savings loan crisis, maybe define that and then talk about what it was like digging out of that.
Yeah. So starting in the 80s and extending into the very early part of the 90s, the savings and loan industry in the United States was pretty much deregulated. And a lot of the savings and loans were getting big by enabling unsecured loans to be originated and used to purchase real estate. An unsecured loan is basically, hey, you know me, loan me some money, I'm going to go buy this thing. Well, this happened on a massive scale. It was really something kind of similar to the real estate crisis, mortgage crisis that kicked off the 2008 recession. And what ended up happening was that when the recession happened in the early 90s, these people couldn't pay for all the real estate that they had bought with these SNL loans. And so the SNL started calling all these loans in, and there was no one to buy the properties. So people just basically either went bankrupt, or they just, said, oh, I'm going to stop paying the loan on this property. And so there became just a deluge of non-performing, underperforming loans on the books of the SNLs. And this had a ripple effect to the economy. And so the George W. Bush, the original OG Bush president, he set up something called the Resolution Trust Corporation to clean this up. And basically, the process of cleaning up the SNL crisis was taking these underperforming loans, repackaging them, and then selling them to new investors or to REITs or other parties that had the cash to buy them. And often these properties were being sold at fire sale prices.
And real quick, like an underperforming loan, like, is that meaning somebody was loaning out money and then nobody was paying the interest on that loan? So it was just kind of sitting there. Okay.
Interesting. Yeah, a non-performing loan means that no payments are being made. Underperforming would mean either they're paying part of the payment, or maybe they're just paying the interest, but they're not paying the principal. And a lot of people would use they would just pay the interest on the loan with the hopes of getting restructured later or ending up in what's known as a workout. And so what we did at the J.E. Robert and Whitehall Securitization Project was to build databases of all of these loans and then enable them to be purchased by other investors. Essentially, we securitized all of this real estate. Sometimes it got packaged up into multiple properties. Sometimes it was just sold property by property. But I was a database and a network guy. And so back in the days before you had the internet the way it is today, before AWS, before all this kind of distributed computing technology, I was creating databases and then connecting them around the country, the US, to different bank centers and building databases of these loans that would then be disposed of, okay, or sold in some way to new investors. And so I got some pretty kind of early hands-on experience in what happens when things go wrong in financial markets, and specifically in real estate and securitization. It was pretty cool. So, but you know, these are not financial events that you want to happen very often, because right now, with as much leverage as there is in the system, if this happens again, it's going to really have a pretty strong ripple effect. And that has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, we've just developed financial products and strategies that are based on borrowing and lending rather than actually valuable underlying assets. It's a big, big argument for crypto, actually.
So if you came to me 5 years ago and I said, "Hi, Dave, what do you do?" And you said, "I tokenize assets," I would very, very slowly back away before running for my life. And I bet a lot of people listening to this podcast also feel that way right now. Like, what is, you're doing what now? To who, what, where, why?
Yeah.
Can you define what it means to tokenize an asset in crypto?
It's really pretty simple. Tokenizing an asset means taking the ownership interest in a new or existing company, meaning the list of holders of the securities or shares or tokens of that asset, and taking them, you know, say from a spreadsheet or some kind of paper or other analog ledger, and turning them into a pro rata distribution of smart contracts. Basically, it's very similar to taking a record like vinyl and then turning it into MP3s. You take a whole album, okay, which consists of, you know, 10 songs, and you turn it into 10 different MP4 files, and you put them onto a thumb drive.
That's a great analogy, and definitely the least threatening way to describe tokenizing assets.
Fantastic. Yeah, we're turning vinyl record albums into MP3s, basically.
Fantastic. So what is the present and future of tokenized assets? Where are we in this process?
So the present right now is a lot of stuff is happening under the surface. There are a lot of builders. It's kind of different than 2017. In 2017, the people building, doing tokenizations, were using tokenization to create fundraising mechanisms. They were raising projects, most of whom didn't have any product at all, and they were selling those tokens as a digital form of a promissory note. You know, they some people called them SAFs, Simple Agreement for Future Tokens, or whatever. That's what the state of tokenization was in 2017 and early 2018. It was usually a non-equity interest in a decentralized project where you would get a token that you'd buy at the price of an early stage startup company, but within, say, 6 to 12 months, you'd be able to sell it in a public market like you could do an IPO. And that's really what ICOs were about. Early stage price, late stage, or public liquidity. That's tokenization 2017. 2019, 2020 tokenization is a totally different thing. First of all, it's not really about raising money. It's really about creating direct ownership. Direct ownership means instead of having a paper share that's being held in custody by a third party, I actually have proven ownership in the form of a smart contract that I can have on a thumb drive or stored somewhere, in a wallet somewhere. And I have permission.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, like, what is the main problem with that indirect ownership model that we currently have?
One, it's extremely inefficient to buy and sell private assets. Try buying and selling interest in a private REIT. Try buying and selling shares in a VC-funded startup. Try buying shares of an income stream derived from a debt pool. Almost all of these markets are by appointment. There's no marketplaces for them. And in order to buy or sell these assets, it requires a tremendous amount of paper and people in order just to affect a transaction. Say you want to buy interests in a private company using your IRA. You can use a self-directed IRA, but you need to fill out tons of forms. You need to send them to the custodian that's managing your IRA. They need to review those forms, and then they need to sign off on them, and then they need to go to another part of the office, carry those forms, and say, send this money via wire to this other company. Then that other company has to process more paperwork, and then finally, you own a share. But the difference is that you own that share only in a single entry ledger that's controlled by either a lawyer or the VP of finance or somebody like that. You took money that you couldn't touch, represented by paper, filled out some more paper, used some paper to transfer ownership, and now you own more paper. If you wanted to go sell those shares in the company that you just bought interest in, you'd have to go through a similar process to ask permission and then fill out a lot of paper. That is the problem.
That's very, very, very well explained. And so it kind of sounds to me like asset tokenization is really about, you know, the peer-to-peer nature of almost like BitTorrent or something like that, where you could go, you could host a file and you could say anybody could come and download this file. So in the same way, you didn't need to ask anybody's permission. You didn't need anything, right? There was no middleman. You just go and you host it and then somebody could see it or whatever. But, you know, in this world of, you know, of these new tokenized financial products, it's much in the same way that you can go and you can say, hey, look, on this exchange, on whatever it's 0x or Kyber Network, I've got, you know, 10 shares of this company, and I'm just going to post it and see who wants to pick up on it.
Yeah, well, that's certainly one of the alpha reasons right there. I used the term direct ownership before. What asset tokenization does is it takes the ownership from third party and it gives it to you. In the contract, in the smart contract, in the token itself, is usually encoded the transfer and trade restrictions. Not all, but most of them. And so what asset tokenization does is it allows you to transfer or trade the asset subject to whatever restrictions are inherent with that asset. It could be that you can't buy or sell that asset unless you are a non-US citizen. In the case of a Reg S, in the case of a Reg D, it might be you have to be an accredited investor to do that, and you have to prove that. In the case of other assets, it might be that you need to be a US accredited investor who lives in the state of Texas. There are all kinds of different ways to encode these allowances and restrictions and capabilities into the token. Today, it's relatively simple, meaning you can't encode all of the rules related to an asset, all the rights, et cetera, in an asset. You can't replicate what's known as a PPM, a private placement memorandum, in a token, but you can make it easier to buy and sell and easier to understand, you know, also easier to restrict the sale of assets by using a smart contract.
So what are the nuts and bolts that actually go into tokenizing an asset? Are there a bunch of legal forms and software scripts on your end and registering this with this government body and that with another government body, and you just take all the work out of it for your end user? Or what's the actual process?
Well, so a lot of that process is already handled when people incorporate their companies or when they've raised money or they're just a company, right? And they just own something. So they've already done that legal stuff. And that's not really our area. Once we know that someone actually owns something and they're going to tokenize interest in it, it's really a matter of taking the cap table. Now, let me really quickly explain what a cap table is. Any company, any asset, anything which has more than two owners has a cap table. A cap table is a ledger. It's like a spreadsheet of the owners, when they bought, how much they paid, how much they own, and under what terms. And it's similar to, you know, blockchain as a ledger. It just encodes all this information. So a cap table encodes the information about who owns how much and what they paid. Every company has one of these things if it has more than one owner. So the process of tokenization is literally taking that ledger, that spreadsheet, and then running it through a hashing algorithm. What that hashing algorithm does is it takes you start with a base smart contract, okay? This is the smart contract for this asset. And then you run that smart contract through the filter of the ownership proportion, like what proportion, who owns how much of the underlying asset. The tokenization splits and creates sub smart contracts, which from the master smart contract, which represents slices of ownership of that original asset. So there's a master smart contract, and then there are the smart contracts which are derived from that, which represent an ownership in the 100% of the major master subcontract, the smart contract. So all you're doing is really all tokens are some software code that says, I own this much of this asset, and this asset is represented by a master smart contract. The process of producing this is relatively prosaic. In Vertalo, we take this the spreadsheet, the cap table, we upload it into our system. Someone chooses a chain. Our preferred chain is Tezos, and we also do Ethereum. It then takes that smart contract and it creates little baby smart contracts from that. And then, Bryce might be 51% and Pizza, you're 49%. Well, we create two more smart contracts and they represent 51% ownership and 49% ownership. And then those are transferred to your wallets.
Damn you, Bryce.
Okay, I know. But he's, you were out for a couple of weeks. So, the board decided to give him a little bit more of the company.
I've been stripped of my merit, my shares, and my pride.
Right? So, but you know what? You can fight back, The other thing is that, Bryce is a good guy. Bryce might decide that, he really wants to have equal ownership with you. So he doesn't have to sell all of that smart contract. He can just sell a percent to you. And he can do that either OTC, hand-to-hand, or he can go to an exchange or an ATS and say, hey, Pizza, I want to sell you 1% of the company. I want to sell you a slice, Pizza. And then he's going to send you a slice of his ownership. And then he transfers that subject to restrictions to you. And now that gets updated in the cap table that Vertalo manages. Now you both own 250% slices of the Bryce and Pizza Corporation. Okay.
That sounds so awesome and so easy.
It is, right? And the thing is that can take, in our system, we did that on stage. You saw me do it live at Crypto Invest Summit. Thank you, Alon Gorin and Joseph Holm. And thank you, everyone who watched. We did that live. We took a pizza corporation. We actually called it Starfleet. Who do we have? We had James Kirk purchase some shares in Starfleet from Jean-Luc Picard. And we did that live on stage because, James T. Kirk wanted to own more of Starfleet. So we did that.
Hey, Crypt Nation, real quick interruption from our wonderful sponsors over at eToro. If you guys haven't had a chance to check them out yet, we talk about them every day. You guys should really go check them out. Just go to crypto101podcast.com/eToro. And Pete, why don't you tell them about them? What is eToro?
It's one of the easiest ways to buy and sell crypto with confidence, first of all. They've been around since 2007. All the assets they have on there have been looked at really, really well. It's legal in over 140 countries and trusted by over 10 million users. So if you're not one of them, why?
Yeah, seriously, you got to be asking yourself that question. And, they've been around since 2007. They started trading crypto assets in 2013. So these cats are the real freaking deal. And my favorite aspect about it is that it's so beginner friendly and it's so expert friendly, but they give you this $100,000 virtual trading simulator so you can practice, executing trades and, technical analysis and all that kind of stuff before you actually put your money where your mouth is. So that's my favorite aspect of the whole thing.
My favorite aspect is how easy it is to sign up. I didn't have to wait days for KYC to be approved or anything like that. Literally within 2 minutes, I was able to use my account.
Yeah, it's nuts. Anyhow, guys, as you know, not all platforms are created equal. So go ahead, check it out for yourself. And then hit us with a DM and let us know what you guys think. All right, back to the show. So let's talk about the main person or the main corporation, who's going to be using your platform. And, when I first spoke with you, I thought you made a very interesting point. You're like, one of the first things you asked me, you're like, hey, have you ever worked for a startup? And has it been a nightmare to handle your stock options and your equity and da 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 da? I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. There's quite friction there. So, could you talk a little bit about how you guys are targeting the startup world and why Vertalo is so needed in that world?
Yeah. So, startups are really interesting. They start out being worthless, and if they make it through their infancy, the company and the underlying stock becomes valuable. Part of the stock of a company is issued in the form of stock options to employees and founders and advisors. And everyone's familiar with these things. But the problem with stock options is stock options are not necessarily valuable until a company gets some serious traction, usually, you know, several years in. And there's not necessarily a market for them. You know, occasionally you'll get companies like Airbnb and Twitter and Uber and Snap and, you know, those kinds of companies that are really, really well known. People understand those companies, and you know, employees at those companies can sell they can exercise their options and sell them to buyers. But for the most part, there's not really a market in startup shares. There's really two ways that startups achieve liquidity, something that people in crypto love. Startups primarily achieve liquidity through M&A or through IPO. In M&A, typically someone comes and buys the company for cash or for stock, and then anyone who owns shares or options gets paid a share based on what the price was. Sometimes there are fire sales and no one makes any money. Sometimes they're super successful and everyone makes money, even the last person who was hired at the company. That M&A market for startups kind of ends at 100 or 150 million. Not too many companies are acquired that are bigger than $150 million. It's just, there's not that many buyers for $150 million startups. The next milestone after 150 million though is 1 billion. And at 1 billion, Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or somebody will take you public because the company's big enough to float. The raise is big enough to pay their fees, and you know it's enough to get exciting for the public markets. There are enough shares to be traded. In between $150 million in market cap and $1 billion in market cap is something I call the gulch of death.
I like that. I don't think I've ever heard that one before.
In the gulch of death is a zombie land apocalypse where startups, you know, stumble around for years waiting for a strategic buyer or hoping to get big enough to go public. And many don't get big enough to go public, and they just kind of languish. And often they end up getting sold for far less than they're worth because there's no other buyer, there's no other exit. Well, there is another way. And the way that Vertalo is interested in promoting to help startups and their employees and their founders and their investors get liquidity is through something called direct listings. If you pay attention to this, you might have seen that Slack did a direct listing a couple months ago.
I heard about that, but I actually didn't necessarily dive into it. What does a direct listing mean? And like, there's just no underwriter, or how's it different?
Exactly. There's no investment bank, which is diluting the shares prior to the offering and then selling those shares to the public and taking fees. A direct listing typically takes the cap table, and it lets insiders, employees, founders, early investors tender their shares, and then they sell the shares to the market on an ATS or an exchange, similar to the way that people have been recently doing IEOs, okay, or the way that people did ICOs. You know, no ICO was mediated by an investment bank. People just went and they sold them, you know, in pre-sales, which is like early stage investing, main sales, which is like late stage investing. And then, ICOs were basically listing their tokens on exchanges where they could be bought by the public. And what direct listings do is it enables venture funded companies to tender their shares and sell them directly to the public. in a market where there are fewer M&A and fewer IPO options, Vertalo believes that direct listings enabled by Vertalo technology is a real possibility to help unlock liquidity for entrepreneurs and their employees. And so that people don't have to hang around at these startups for 10 years, wasting their lives. As someone who's done that and been in that situation himself and who owns interests in multiple private companies, I can tell you that any way that can bring more liquidity for employees and entrepreneurs at startup companies sounds like a good thing to me. And so what we believe is that digital asset tokenization, the combination of direct ownership and direct listing and connecting to exchanges and ATSs like Open Finance and T0 and the long-term stock exchange and the Singapore exchange, this can provide a really, really interesting opportunity for venture-funded companies and other kinds of companies too to obtain improved liquidity from the benefits of this technology by using digital asset tokenization. So what I'm saying is that digital asset tokenization is not a fundraising mechanism like it was for ICOs, but so-called security tokens, digital asset tokenization is actually the third way to liquidity as compared to M&A or IPO. And it's a way out of the desert, of the gulch of death for so many companies. That's my dream. That's my vision. And we're building a platform that's enabling that. And not going to build a platform. You saw it. You saw it on stage. Continue to build. Are distributing a technology to finally help startup employees and entrepreneurs and asset owners get out of private asset positions by improved liquidity, direct ownership, direct listing, the third way.
So you mentioned Open Finance and T0, for example. These are exchanges that are part of the decentralized finance movement, otherwise known as DeFi, one of my favorite things to say. Will we still need these centralized legacy exchanges and companies to do things for us? Or do you think DeFi will just come in through and wipe them all out?
No, to your last question. DeFi itself can enable the transfer between parties of certain assets. Like DEXs are great, but they can only really trade certain kinds of assets. As long as the rule of law is strong in countries like the United States, Korea, Japan, the United Kingdom, Germany, France, even China, buying and selling assets without investor protections, without accreditation, without knowledge rights, is going to be limited. So it's not so much DeFi. I say more direct ownership is going to come to the rescue. And a more clarity around what can be bought and sold on crypto-friendly centralized exchanges and ultimately, down the road, decentralized exchanges.
So ultimately, there's a power that at play here that decides who can buy what and when and how. And when I ask around and I say, who is this power? The answer I get more often than not is the Financial Action Task Force, otherwise known as FATF.
Yeah.
And this is some international group of people that, for whatever reason, all the exchanges are listening to whatever their guidelines are.
Yeah.
They're not backed by an army that I know of. I don't know who their chairman is. Yet we seem to live in extreme fear of whatever these guys say has to be done. Can you give us a little bit of insight on what the Financial Action Task Force is and why we need to listen to them?
Well, the FATF is the owner or the purveyor of the travel rule, okay? And so the travel rule is a kind of worldwide agreement that firms, banks, and other fiduciaries must know who the owner of an asset is before enabling it to be bought or sold. So because we operate, Vertalo operates within the confines of the regulated markets, we are travel rule compliant. I don't see any time in the near future where traditional assets, which have been registered or even are exempt within countries like the United States, Korea, Japan, UK, et cetera, are going to be exempt from the travel rule. What the travel rule is doing is it contains capital flight. It's meant to prevent money laundering and financial crimes. The Panama Papers certainly didn't make anyone want to relax, you know, these rules. And so I think we're, you know, for the most part, you know, if you're trafficking or your business is, you know, real world assets, not equivalents, not cryptocurrencies, that you're going to have to live with the travel rule for quite some time.
And that's that nobody could travel with more than $10,000. Is that right? Internationally? Is that the
truth? No, well, it's really that, you know, if the transactions are over a certain amount, then they are subject to compliance regulations. Okay. It's really like when you get over $1,000. Okay. But, you know, it's not really meant for that. Those are small time transactions. What they're really trying to do is keep there from being these massive multi-million dollar transferences of assets for tax avoidance. That's really what the travel rule is about. And for me to speak more about the travel rule, other than to say there's that, you know, if you want to operate in the big markets, and, you know, Vertalo is interested in the large asset markets like real estate and venture, you're going to have to sign disclosures that everything you do are compliant with that. It's just the lawyers more than the regulators, because the lawyers don't want to get sued by their clients for failing to comply with applicable law. So I don't think that the FATF is really enforced at the barrel of a gun, but I think it's very legally compelling, and it's enforced as much by your own lawyers as it is by any government institution.
What a pain in the ass. I really wish that the law and legislation and all that stuff would keep up with the evolution of technology, but I guess you'd have to take a much larger macro look at the history of investing to realize why these rules are in place in the first place. I'm just a guy in crypto who wants to make money and retain my anonymity.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, as we all know, that even blockchain technologies themselves are not necessarily anonymous. It's very, anonymity is tough. One of the things that we did to help with anonymity is that whenever we create a new digital asset, we create keyless custodial wallets in our system that have never been seen before. So you can invest in something or have an ownership in something which has been tokenized or digitized in our platform. And you don't have to bring some kind of dog-eared MetaMask wallet that you've been using for all your other deals to store that ownership in. We can create and spawn a new wallet for you, and that is keyless. And then if you want to move those that ownership to some new wallet that you spawn that has no history, that no one associates you with, then you can do that in our system as well.
That's great.
So, you know, for private assets, you know, the first word in that is private. Okay. Like, you know, you should be able to keep private those things that you own. And we're really, really dedicated to privacy and security. Specifically, if you own interest in a company or something, you don't necessarily want everyone to know that. Not everyone puts all their holdings onto Crunchbase or LinkedIn, you know? So we've designed technology around that. It does two things. One, it maintains anonymity, but Vertalo is strongly fixated on knocking down the barriers to tokenization. And the biggest barriers, frankly, are wallets and tokens. Nerds that are listening here, you all know that you guys are way smarter than normals, and you can operate all this stuff. You could work at a command line. You know how to run a node. Normal people don't know how to run nodes. They don't know how to use a wallet. They don't know about private keys. That's why Coinbase was so successful. What we're trying to do is we're trying to take a page from that. We're trying to take a page from AOL, which is this internet thing, which is, everyone jokes about AOL, but AOL was the on-ramp for the internet. It's why the internet got big in the United States. It's because it was super easy to use and no need to learn how to use a modem. You know how to use a modem? You know how to get onto a Usenet? No one wants to do that.
I remember before AOL, you had to open Internet Explorer or whatever, and then a window would pop up and you'd have to type in a phone number to dial, and you'd have to know which, what your ISP was. And it was completely impossible to figure all that stuff out. But yeah, I could go down to Target and pick up a free AOL CD and pop it in and I'd be online.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how come the internet got big. And then once those training wheels were off, some people stayed with AOL because they liked the content, but other people figured out other ways to do things. And and then broadband happened, et cetera. Vertalo is in that way, similar to AOL. We're going to help these assets get online. Right now they're stuck on spreadsheets. We think that people are going to be able to participate in a lot more investment activity and a lot more different kinds of things if we can help the private asset markets modernize. So things are easy as Coinbase or E-Trade to buy crypto denominated or configured assets. And that's what we're doing.
That's awesome. So speaking of making things easy, I'd like you to break down a few terms for our listeners. What is the difference between an exchange, a broker dealer, a clearinghouse, and a custodian?
Okay, well, let's see. Some broker dealers are ATSs, okay? An alternative trading system. Okay, so some broker dealers are ATSs. That means they can trade either stock that they helped create or stock that someone wants to trade, okay? The ATS, my co-founder Gautam could help you more with ATSs, but he wrote the first paper at the SEC on ATSs. So we know a little bit about ATSs here. Great. Open finance is an ATS, and they're also a broker dealer. A custodian is a chartered and licensed holder of funds. There's two kinds. There's state and there's federal custodians. They can hold funds in trust for others. And let's see, what are the other terms you want to
clearinghouse.
A clearinghouse is kind of the old-fashioned thing. What the clearinghouse does is it settles trades that have been performed between two parties, maybe two broker dealers or, any two parties. The blockchain itself has its own clearing mechanism. So, we use blockchain. You actually don't have to have a clearinghouse because the blockchain settles and clears trades by itself. That's what the protocols do.
So can an exchange like Open Finance be all four of those things?
Not typically, no. Regulators tend to wall off certain capabilities. So can't be a custodian. Broker dealers can run ATSs. Broker dealers aren't typically custodians. And settlement is typically done either manually or depending on whether it's public or private through a third party.
Gotcha. Well, thank you so much for clearing that up. And I think we just have a couple more questions, or is this our last one here?
Yeah. One of the things I really like to ask people that come on the show is if this was the first podcast, this Crypto 101, right? So a lot of people, this is the first time they're tuning into a podcast. So what's like a little nugget of wisdom from your vantage point that you could impart under these good crusaders of Crypt Nation?
My nugget of wisdom. Well, let's say, I would say if you start a company, start it with someone that you love and you trust. I think that's the most important thing. If you all out there have a great idea and you want to make it even greater, don't do it by yourself. I would say that doing things by yourself for the most part is probably a mistake. So find a great person that you can work with through thick and thin, and that you know that you can confidently trust, and that complements you.
You it sounds guys like marriage that. Advice, Dave.
It's absolutely marriage advice. That, you know, there's two people that when you're starting a company, there are two kinds of people that you get married to. One of them is your co-founder, and the other one is your investors. So choose your co-founders wisely, and definitely have a co-founder. It's very difficult. Even Jeff Bezos had a co-founder. Her name is Mackenzie. Okay.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah.
Behind the scenes. Yeah.
Okay. And then the other thing is your investors. Choose your investors wisely because you're getting married to them. A bad investor will never make up for the money they put into your company.
That's great wisdom. And I definitely completely agree 100%. Even if I only have 49% share so far, I definitely feel like this is a great partnership that I have here with Bryson Pizza Incorporated.
Real quick, back to Mackenzie. So I just Googled her. So that's Mackenzie Bezos. So were they married before Amazon? Or was it? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, she drove the car across country. They met at the investment bank that Jeff was working at. And then she drove the car while he worked on the business plan and all this other stuff for Amazon. And there would have been no, I don't think I'm definitely not the first person to say this. There would have been no Amazon if there was no Mackenzie. And she, everyone needs a partner. You got to choose a great one. You got to, if you're married, choose a great spouse. If you're starting a company, choose a great co-founder. If you're getting investors, choose great investors. And once you start that company, you've got that great co-founder and those great investors, choose great partners because it's very, very difficult. There's no companies in this space, especially in the digital asset space, that can go it alone. And anyone who tells you that they are an end-to-end solution, run away from people who say they're end-to-end because that's the end of you. Okay. Yeah. You don't want to work with people who are end to end.
You want specialties.
You want people who can work with other people, and you're going to encounter that. So I was like, just be able to work with other people. It's very, very important.
Super important. Surround yourself with good people, and they always say you are a combination of the five people you spend most of your time with. So thanks for reminding us of that and for sharing a ton of awesome information about the future of tokenization and assets. And I mean, man, we covered a lot of ground, DeFi and broker dealers and all that kind of stuff. Dave, thank you for joining us. Hopefully you could come back on the pod one of these days.
Pizza, Bryce, I love you guys. Keep doing what you're doing. And if anyone here is interested, they can learn more at www.vertalo.com.
Great. Thanks so much, David. Where can the good people of Crypt Nation reach out to you directly? On Twitter or Telegram?
Yeah, I'm on Telegram. I'm on all the grams. So you can find me on Twitter at Dave Hendricks. That's DaveHendricks. I'm the number one Dave Hendricks on the internet. So if you just put Dave Hendricks into your handy search bar, you'll find me pretty quickly.
And the number one Dave Hendricks in our hearts as well. Thank you so much, Dave, for coming on the show. We'll see you soon.
Talk to you all later.